Audio version of Michael Leitman's blog. August 31st, 2019. My article in Newsmax, Amazon fires and a burning need for human connection. The ripple effect of thousands of Amazonian fires is sensed across the continents. As if humanity needed a reminder of the interconnected, integral, and rounded world we live in, the record devastation of the South American rainforest has produced a global outcry. There is mounting international pressure on Brazil to save the Earth's largest rainforest, an area around half the size of the US, which produces 20% of our planet's oxygen. But restoring the lungs of the planet depends solely on mending the exploitative and destructive relations on the human level. Now the focus is on the Amazonian fires, allegedly set by ranchers and farmers to clear land for cultivation and cattle, but it is important to keep in mind that the global environmental crisis requires a wider perspective. Even though impressive satellite images show that an area the size of a soccer field is burned in the Amazon every minute, let's not forget that the effect of the world's environmental problems such as global warming, melting glaciers, unprecedented high temperatures, air and ocean pollution, and ozone depletion are no less appalling in their consequences for people's quality of life. Addressing climate challenges demand a broad outlook because the entire ecosystem is integral. There are four levels in nature: still, vegetative, animate, and human. The climate crisis currently affecting us stems from flawed human interactions alone and not as a result of people's corporeal actions. It is an outcome of our broken relations and lack of inner connection. As our sages wrote, "Man is a small world, the world is a great man." Avot Drabi Natan, Chapter 31. If we develop positive mutual relations at the level of our thoughts, attitudes, and behaviors toward each other, we cause a ripple effect both throughout human society and nature. But, if we relate negatively to one another, aiming to harm and exploit each other for personal benefit, then we experience negative reactions from nature. Lessons from nature. The fires in the Amazon give humanity an enlightening lesson about our relationships. It is revealed how interdependent we are, and on the other hand, we see how our ego makes us take advantage of others. The contradiction between the two makes crisis break out in every field. This time the focus is ecological, with emphasis on the fires in the Amazon, but it manifests in all levels of nature. From this lesson, we must become aware of the absolute integral system we live in, which increasingly reveals itself before our eyes. A demand for true global leadership. As long as our egoistic approach remains unrestrained and unregulated, and as long as no country really cares about the global ecological balance but only its own territory, there is no reason to point an accusing finger at Brazilian President Bolsonaro for rejecting the G7 leaders' financial assistance led by Emmanuel Macron. Bolsonaro understands very well that the West's motivation to help him stems from a desire to exploit his country's natural resources, as expressed by world leaders who have held conferences only for their self-promotion. My recommendation to the President of Brazil is that he should demand from the wealthy countries at least $20 million per month for the world's oxygen produced by Brazilian rainforests. By the way, this sum is a mere pittance, half the cost of the G7 summit in Biarritz to which France diverted its taxpayers' money. Although this pressure would most likely provoke even more fiery reactions among world leaders than the burning forest, it would also raise awareness about our human nature and the need for mutual responsibility between peoples and countries. Even if we apply pressure on politicians, donate millions to stop deforestation, reduce meat consumption and cease importing meat from Brazil, we will still need to cure not only the compromised lungs of the planet but the entirety of humanity's body. How can we make the broader healing of humanity possible? It can be done by igniting human connection, the education and promotion of the need to connect today, and a method for how to connect. Why would we want to do so? It is because we all live under one common roof, where the world is our home. Protecting and preserving our common future depends on our understanding that divided we perish, united we thrive, and we take the entire surrounding nature with us. What to do with a dream if everything is predetermined? Question: if everything is predetermined, what should we do with dreams? Should we not dream? Answer: dream of quickly reaching the most perfect state in the world. The fact is that all nature is predetermined. It drags us forward either via a good, bad, or middle path. The wisdom of Kabbalah discusses this. Read Balhasulam's articles. Everything is explained there. The only problem is to accelerate this development and make it more comfortable. Do not just speed up and ride through the bumps on a bad road, but turn the road into a freeway so that you pass it quickly and comfortably. The future goal has already been set. We are inside it, we only have to reveal it. From the Kabbalah lesson in Russian, the 28th of April 2019. New Life number 1137. Peace between nations.
Hello, and thanks for being with us on the New Life Show with Dr. Michael Lightman. Hello, Dr. Lightman. Hello, everyone. Hello, Nitzamazos. Hello. And today we'd like to talk about peace agreements between countries. We'd like to understand how to get it right in order to make our life better and safer. Be with us, Nitza, please. Yeah, just to mention that the aspiration for peace altogether is something that's been around forever. While preparing myself for this show, I read about it, and I saw that actually the very first peace treaty to be signed was in the 13th century BC, between the Egyptian and the Hittite king, and it's a very ancient agreement. Very famous. It's something that you study about in international relations and so on. And we're talking about two countries that were previously at war, and at a certain point they couldn't conquer each other, and so they moved to a strategy of attrition warfare. And they saw that there too they have many casualties. And at a certain point they reached the understanding that probably they have to reach some kind of a peace treaty. By the way, it was written in both languages, in the ancient Egyptian language of hieroglyphs, and also in the language of the Hittites. And to this day it's presented in the UN and in other places. And maybe the first question that we'd like to ask that stems from our aspiration for peace, for a peace agreement between countries, we see that this is a very ancient idea, but still we see that peace agreements are unsustainable. And in the long run, it doesn't work. So maybe the first question is, why do we have an aspiration for peace if we see that over time it doesn't really work? Well, this is a question that for as long as people have been around in groups, then of course this is a question that concerns and worries everyone. What is peace? Shalom in Hebrew, that comes from the word shlemut, meaning wholeness and perfection. So, is peace only a state where there's no war, or is there also connection, or is it a state where we're so integrated in one another that we stop seeing you and me, but it's the both of us together? Peace is something very deep. I'd say that it elevates us to superhuman levels, not philosophically wise, but to our root, which is one, which is the root of nature. And why are we divided into males and females and so many species and the nations of the world and so on and so forth? And that there are so many differences, and today you have about 8 billion people in the world, each with their own ego, and no one is really at peace with themselves, and it's really the main world problem. And it's a natural human aspiration. I don't think anyone aspires for it anymore. Maybe we lost hope that it could happen. Well, according to your story about the Hittite king and Pharaoh, I see that they reached some kind of a peace agreement because they had no choice. Yeah, we really see that all peace agreements throughout history were always signed after bloody wars. And from attrition, and because there's no choice, meaning it's not an agreement that comes from wholeness, perfection, and completion, which is the meaning of peace in Hebrew. But let's sign an agreement in order not to kill each other anymore. You killed enough of my soldiers, I killed enough of your soldiers, and I don't think that that's called peace. I don't think that it has any good future. It never did, either. But it helps for some time. In previous times, there were different kinds of treaties, agreements, connections made between different countries, these against those, and those against these, and different agreements. In short, it's like children playing the same way kings played with each other. So also part of the agreement was that if another empire attacks, some third factor comes into the picture, then they help each other. Yeah, these are natural, egoistic things that surely awaken in everyone, and they're clear, and since then there are such and such agreements and different kinds, and there are many studies about it, and really dozens and dozens of books were written about every war, and we see how afterwards each and every war is being studied, and still, there is no peace. Were I to ask you, is peace the opposite of a state of war, or these things are unrelated? No. There are ceasefire agreements, different kinds of agreements, different kinds of truce, weapon restrictions, what do we use, what can't we use against each other, and so on. Meaning, it has nothing to do with peace, shalom in Hebrew. That comes from the word shlemut, meaning wholeness and perfection. It's a state where we think that we really should be connected, that this is how things should be. And the result of a peace agreement, if it's really a peace agreement, should be connection, mutual integration, and really the birth of a new reality where there's no you and I, but there is something common between us. And this is how it continues. But we see that it doesn't happen because each and every nation has a root of its own, and so it can't agree with another nation and feel the other nation like it feels itself. And any king or pharaoh or whoever it is feels himself and his ego, and he's related to his nation. And therefore, all of these agreements, I'd say that they're only a temporary ceasefire, meaning it's not real peace. No. Can a peace agreement lead to a true peace agreement? Again, it's on condition that we understand what a true peace agreement is. And are we really ready for it? For this, we have to educate these kings, to teach them what a peace agreement is, and also the nations themselves, and for an extended period of time, where we're mutually integrated in one another. Usually it's through marriage. To this day, here and there, it's still done in royal families. And then by that, as if, even though that later on it didn't help. In the past 300 years in Europe, it didn't really help. They still fought. But it was somehow, meaning they wanted to build peace based on realistic corporeal roots by connecting families. You mentioned conditions that in order to reach peace, first of all, you have to understand the conditions. So the common conditions for peace agreements today are the following. First of all, the countries have to agree on their borders. The territory. Not good. Why? There are no borders. What do you mean? No borders. You're talking in the optimum state. Yeah, there are no borders. Everything is in a common territory. And there's no difference who's where and so on. But in our common territory, everyone's free. If it's peace, if it's real peace. Yeah, if it's not just a ceasefire. So if you want to build real peace, the first condition is, first of all, integration. We open our borders and we create a common area. Yeah. Second thing is that we discuss different ways of how to solve possible future conflicts. Because we take into consideration that we made an agreement now, it doesn't mean that in the future there won't be disputes or misunderstandings, and what do you do then? How do you solve that in the future? Incorrect approach too, because there's no in the future. In the future, we don't see any dispute between us, because we're working toward a state where there's no between us, but there is one, we. The army, that if someone attacks us, that will have one army. All the government offices, all the taxes, all the crops, everything that we have, it's all common, collective. It's the property of both nations that are connected in peace. So we actually don't think about possible future disputes. To the contrary, we now have to erase all those things that can show us that there is any kind of difference between us. Neither disputes nor wars, but in general. Meaning, wherever we see that there is a difference between me and you, to erase it. To do everything that we can in order for it not to happen. And what about the resources? I started understanding that suppose in a certain country it has certain resources. Everything's common, collective. It's not that we connect one way or another, but we build the entire system of management, taxes, army. Everything's together. There's no difference between us. Of course, it's a process, but we're working on this process all the time. So what do both sides have to concede in order to have a peace agreement? Our personal, limited, and narrow ego. And to see ourselves in the future as one people, in one area, on one piece of land, and there's no longer you and I, but we. If there are debts between us, what do we do about that? We build some kind of a ministry that takes care of all of these things, like it is with one nation. So there's no debt of one kind or another. Let's put it this way. When a man and a woman come together and they start building one family, then whatever each of the sides brings with them, this is what we start with. Okay, another matter is refugees or prisoners of war. What happens with that? Nothing. Everyone's free. If so, then what does each nation keep? The only thing that we're really concerned with and care about is how to develop our mutual integration, this diffusion into each other. Is there something that a nation nonetheless keeps of its own? No, Nothing? Nothing. Culture? Culture, please, no problem. But we really love these cultures and we're intermingled in them and there's no difference between them. If it's to really go forward, then we really appreciate the integration of men and women from both sides for them to build mixed families and so on. Okay, now what do you do about a nation's feelings? Two nations, they fought for years. They wanted to kill each other. What do you do about how they feel? Because you see that even after there's an agreement between the countries, the hostility between the nations, it doesn't end. I don't know. Tell me, please. When a couple fights, and afterwards they decide to make up, so they feel a greater, stronger taste in their connection and making up? Yeah, they do. Because, as it says, love covers for all crimes, because then the love, it becomes more conspicuous, it has a much stronger flavor, it's deeper, and there's devotion, and the desire to show the other that I want to make concessions, and that I'm keeping our connection, and they keep it too, and show it. In short, adding fuel to the fire, so that there is strong hostility shouldn't intimidate us. No. Love covers for all crimes. But against that strong hostility that appears, you're saying above, love covers above the crimes. So, with a couple, this I understand, you cover it with love. But between countries, how do you... In our connection, from it, we can really thrive. Suddenly we find out how much we benefit from peace, from connection, from our physical integration, financial integration, military integration, such agreements in which nations come together, it could really make a nation thrive. We don't see such examples in history, that one swallows the other, maybe, also barely, but maybe in ancient times where... In short, I don't think that it's possible, but suppose. Because still, after a few hundreds of years, that nation, one way or another, gets up and leaves. But a real peace agreement can bring to a state where nations unite. And they really become, meaning there's this saying, to turn your enemy into your lover. It sounds like this exalted ideal. Is it possible? It's possible, and furthermore, the love that comes after the hate really shows how united we are because we're different. Specifically this way. All of the forces of nature, each and every force can't appear in and of itself, per se, but only one opposite the other. Comes the one and points at the other, so to speak. And therefore that there's hate before it. This later leads to the eruption of love, outbreak of love. If we're talking about a young couple that sometimes fight, after that, they have a connection, and if they can overcome it, then really the connection grows. Okay, now, were we to write down the main principles of a peace agreement, what are they? You want me to tell you? Yeah, the main principles for peace. Principles for peace that we want to reach a connection, at the end of which we will not be able to tell ourselves apart in anything. But the same way that I relate to my own people, this is how I relate to your people. We create a partnership between us on all levels. Partnership in terms of the family, the city, the country, and good things and bad things, in everything and for all times, as one. Where we still see that there are differences between us, then we work on it. We accept it that we're different here. Suppose it's two nations, white and black, and that it's even evident to the eye. I have to reach a state where my attitude toward them will truly be equal. It's interesting. I talked to many people. This was in Hollywood. We went there to film something with Larry King. And I asked, there was a really mingled group. There was a Chinese person, an Arab Orthodox woman, a French woman, and another American guy, kind of a pluralist. And so we talked, and they said, I think that almost from the bottom of their heart, that it's very hard for them to identify people by their origin. That they're so integrated in it, intermingled in it from childhood, that even that Orthodox Arab woman, meaning everyone said that it's hard, meaning you have to make a real effort in order to differentiate who's who and where they're from and so on. Everyone talks English. Everyone was born in the United States. Everyone studies in the university, meaning they're educated. They're also friends in a certain way. And this is how it is. Meaning what created the process of the unification of their connection is that they actually made a kind of partnership between them. Yeah, even though that there is a difference between the religions, between the nations, but still, no. I saw that even the young Arab woman, even though that her head is covered and everything, she looked very religious. But still, according to her attitude, she was very open. I want to ask about one more thing. Usually when you make a peace agreement, we know that peace agreements are made by diplomats from the one country and the other country. Now, besides the diplomats or the heads of state, there are all the citizens of the one country and the citizens of the other country. The way you see it, a peace agreement signed by leaders from both countries, is it a sustainable peace agreement? Or do citizens from both countries have to also be in some kind of interaction between them? They have to interact. How? Not in regard to the agreement itself, because the agreement just has to be signed, but there has to be a referendum. There has to be serious work done with both nations in terms of explanation, a deep, profound explanation, discussions. The nations have to meet. There should be some kind of integration at schools, universities, to really have picnics, do different things. Really, everyone has to get to know the others in a good and nice way. But I'll tell you, I grew up in Russia. And the policy was to, as if, unite, connect the nations. And people accepted it in a pretty open way, even though that it was pretty external, and the talk about it was only a political thing. But still, many people accepted it as something good, nice, and many people from different nations got married and came closer. So there's a certain process that after you sign the agreement, the two nations have to go through a certain process of integration, of getting to know each other. Yeah, it really depends, and I see that it also happens in the United States. One more question. When you talked about it, you described the state of peace as a state where the differences between people are erased completely. You remember the 60s? Yes. The world started talking about world peace, love between people. I was a student back then. Peace and love, those were the times. Why do you think it didn't work? There was a broad international movement that wanted peace and love. No, not peace and not love. It was completely political. No, I'm talking about ordinary people. It didn't come from people. I don't know where it came from. Citizens, ordinary people said that they want peace and love. Songs were written about it. Movies were made about it. Maybe it was initiated by politicians, but people accepted it. There was this kind of aspiration in the world. Why didn't it pan out? Many years later, we see that it didn't work. And why are you optimistic about it today? I'm not? No. I'm only answering according to what she's asking about what real peace is, but I'm not saying that it's sustainable. It's not? No? Then why did you talk about it? Because she asked what true peace is. What can make peace sustainable? This is the question. For this, you need lengthy education that comes from the depth of nature, from the wisdom of Kabbalah, and then we can really reach it. But it's on condition that we invest in it, that we delve into the depth of the wisdom of Kabbalah, we get all of these foundations out of there, we know how to build the different educational systems, and after several years, not a year or two, but 5, 10 years, we start seeing how we're starting to move. And as a result, we start building not only some kind of theoretical education, but we're starting to change the face of the nation, the country, the world, and only then is it possible. So, to add to the previous principles of peace that we talked about, there is another principle that peace between nations depends on the understanding of the laws of nature. Of course, otherwise, how can it work? So, what is this principle? It's the global principle that says what? That all of mankind and all of nature are a global system that really works in a global, mutual way, in an integral way. And only mankind does not keep this law. And therefore, we cause harm to the entire world and to all of nature. And it's possible to correct it only through the people of Israel, which is a people that consists of people from all nations, and to the extent to which they will be able to connect, this will bring connection to the entire world, because the people of Israel are made from, they consist of parts from all nations. Dr. Leitman, what's the most important thing from everything that we talked about today when we think about a peace agreement between countries? There's nothing more important than peace. This is the only thing that we have to come to and aspire for. And there's a method of how to do it. Dr. Leitman, thank you very much. Thank you, Nitza. Thank you for being with us. Till next time, all the best.